Hello, and welcome to AI JCast, a podcast featuring conversations and performances at the intersection of art, inspiration, and justice. I'm your host, Marthame Sanders. On this episode, part two of our conversation with ARC Executive Director Khaled Keefe Perry. As we mentioned last time, we did have some issues with the audio quality. However, the content is very much worth listening to. Khaled and I talked online as he joined us from his office.
One of the things that's important to you and your work is to make justice and equity part of an organization's, make it more than just aspirations and intentions, right? So there's something about the visual or aesthetic impact of having a table that looks very different in terms of who's there. And that matters. And it's also critical that that visual piece has an embodied piece as well.
Yeah. And I think the embodiment piece is really important for us. Look, it's and among many of the circles that you and I kind of travel within, what would constitute kind of left-leaning or radical, depending on who you're talking to, progressive Christian circles. Let's just say that, mm-hmm. right? There's probably other circles that we're both part of, but let's just say that one. There's a huge emphasis on kind of, quote, diversity. I'll put a big D, right. Big D there.
Right.
A lot of that is well-intentioned, but it doesn't actually ever do the work of changing who's in power.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So the danger here, and this is really, it's not, you go to a large liberal seminary divinity school, and you think about who's on their board or who's in staff, and maybe they're doing lip service to wanting to do have greater diversity, and so there's more folks around the table who are folks of color or come from historically marginalized communities. But then if you actually do a power audit and you try to say who has decision-making power here, who is getting paid around here, who has the mm-hmm. capacity to then bring other people to the table, many of these places where diversity is being championed on the one hand still shakes down to an institution that looks not that different than it did 100 years ago, but there's more brown folks around the table,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
right? Well, so then we need to begin to say, is it just about the stuff that's around the table? Well, obviously not, because in that example, the people around the table seem to be pretty good. Now we need to start thinking also about the effect of that around the table and dig a little bit deeper. How are our decisions being made, right? How mm-hmm. are the paychecks being issued? Who's able to be involved in all of the operations and machinations of this organization, this community, this festival, you know, whatever mm-hmm. it is you want mm-hmm. to think about. And so I think, you know, there is an overlap where I think there's really good intentions in a lot of institutions that are kind of liberal institutions, say, that they recognize as a problem. Maybe they don't name it as white supremacy or, you know, heteronormativity or, you know, whatever it is. But I think that there is a time and a place where you need to kind of step back and say, are we somehow just play acting at change?
Right.
Are we just putting all the pieces there so that on the surface this looks good?
Mm.
And I mean, I think that's one of the biggest places where we get into trouble, or where, you know, ARC gets into trouble, when people think that we're just talking about what in academic literature gets called mere aestheticism. That's kind of like wallpapering over problems so it looks better. We're not talking about mere aestheticism. We want to do a kind of serious, significant kind of questioning of what are the values of an organization? How do we do that? And in my own work, this is really important, because I end up working with organizations or individuals who really do think they want real change. But what they haven't recognized is that real change will necessarily come along with things being done a different how, mm-hmm. a different way. And that feels incredibly uncomfortable for people
mm-hmm.
in these organizations. if I'm being generous, I can say, yes, there's a desire for change. But a lot of times what that looks like is people want to maintain exactly the same feeling, exactly the same how, but somehow have it be different. And that's not realistic. And so then the commitment, the work to do with folks to say, if you really want change, recognize that how you operate is going to be different. Who you operate with and what you get to do will change as a result of your increasing commitments to justice. The ability to kind of do the same thing you've always done, but somehow have it be more just is a fallacy. And it's a kind of liberal piece of propaganda. If you really want to be doing a change work, probably people in leadership are going to need to change. You're going to need to think about what legacy sustaining looks like. What does transition look like for leadership? How do you get other people to the table so they can get paid?
Well, and organizationally speaking, I'm curious the challenge. I think there's a different challenge, but I'd be curious to hear your take on it between the transformation of an existing organization as opposed to the collapsing of one and then the birthing of a new. Do you see that in the work that you do?
Yeah. I mean, so this is a perfect example that we've just been having this conversation in ARC's board around, you know, what our eventual transition will be with me out of the role of executive director, right? So I gave you the story of SARC's kind of origin and then transition. Well, we're in a moment right now where we're kind of just getting on our feet for some new initiatives to come out the door, for us to kind of be feeling like an organization that people who were legacy members of the organization from the 60s, 70s, and 80s still recognize the commitments of the organization from then now. Okay? Mm-hmm. However, it's also the case that a lot of people who would never have been interested in what we were doing 30 years ago are now interested. So there's a new breath of life in the organization, right? Mm. Okay. Well, if in this moment of financial precarity and brand newness, we said, you know, it's super important. We need to make sure we hand off this organization to someone so that instead of having Khaled be the executive director, we have someone in there who looks better for what we're doing. We have had an explicit conversation around how it's unethical and would be unjust and part of the white supremacist kind of framework if an organization that wasn't stable, we let someone step up to the plate at who was, like, say, a person of color so that they could have this position. Meanwhile, they would get it and it would fail.
Right.
Or not. You know, maybe they would be successful. But
you're setting them up for fairly potential failure.
Too often when people try to go through the transformation moment, they hand off these barely afloat organizations as a last-ditch effort. I mean, I know of seminaries that have done this, where the first time ever they have a president of color, it's when they're totally at the end of their rope and they don't want to send them, like, oh, let's try this. You know. Instead, we've been having a conversation about our transition. Like, what does it look like for us to be have a good reserve, a good piece of money set aside, stable networks, stable partnerships, ongoing operations scheduled, and then bring in excellence that isn't me? And so we've been having a conversation, and one of the board members said to me, you know, I want to push back on the timeline that you want to get out of your seat. We don't want to be able to try and do a search and a hire to replace you until we're sure that that person is going to be able to be in that position without struggle. Now, there'll be some back and forth, right?
Sure.
And then part of the task as a white person, especially as a white male that passes the street, part of the task is knowing that some people will criticize my leadership because I'm a white male, right? And that just has to be something I deal with. Because I get so many bonuses and so many rest of my life that if I can't handle people having issues with me being white, then I shouldn't be in this game at all.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So my team, you know, the people who ultimately tell me what to do, right? So we take the executive director position pretty seriously in ARC in the sense that, like, I don't vote. I'm not on the committee of the board. They make all the decisions and I execute them. And what we know is because I'm a white male that has, you know, experience in the academy and in ministry and in some art settings, I can get into some doors that some of the other folks who are part of our board couldn't, either because they're women or because they're folks of color or both or, you know, whatever. And I get to use my privilege to help sustain and get this organization in a more robust place so that at some point in time, my position can be a more than quarter time thing, which is what it is now, so that it can come maybe with some benefits, which it doesn't now. And we can have a real nice thing to offer to someone. And then I'll be off to the next thing that I can do because I look like me. Right. But that's an internal conversation. I mean, obviously we're having it externally too, but the point is like,
nobody listens to this podcast.
That's
all right.
That's not on our website. That's not like that's sure. 'Cause that's not the work. This is just how we think all organizations should be thinking. This is just part of what operations should be if you're actually concerned with equity and justice.
Well, talk us through some of the programs, projects of ARC, whether it's current, upcoming, whatever you want to share with us.
Yeah, so there are kind of three long-term kind of pieces in terms of events that, ARC does. In the spring... every year, we host what we call the Theopoetics Conference. And that's somewhere in the neighborhood of 80 to 100 folks who come from all over the country. Last year, we had folks come in from Australia and New Zealand, which is pretty wild because it's just a weekend. But that is exciting. So this is people, you know, it's a mix. About a third who folk have come who are academics. Maybe a third are clergy and a third are artists. And they're all people who kind of whose work intersects at the kind of at the kind of crossroads of commitments to caring about the positive concern for the body, embodiment, around the ways in which the arts can be reflective of transcendence, ways in which religious life can be reflected authentically and powerfully in the arts, and how that the arts and religious reflection can be part of building up communities and work towards justice. So the various commitments that people have are different. Different doctrinal perspectives, confessional perspectives, all kinds of different stuff. But we have this event, and it's in some ways like a three-ring circus in that, you know, maybe as many as a third of the people who are there are presenters. So there's an open call for proposals. Folks can go to theopoeticsconference.org, and the call for proposals goes out all through the fall, and people propose workshops, people propose seminars, performance art, all kinds of different stuff. And then we select, I think we do 18 different things that happen over the course of a full day. We have dialogues that happen. People host conversations where they don't really know what to do, but they're like, this seems important. Will you come and talk to me about this stuff? We'll have some podcasts that we'll record there. You know, so there's a lot of stuff that kind of happens. And a lot of the reason folks come is because they have found in this community other people who are engaged in some of the same questions they are, even if the actual specifics of what they're doing are totally different.
Right.
People who understand how important this conversation is and how few places there are to have a conversation like this. Right.
Callie Keith Perry on AIJcast. We'll be back to more of our conversation in just a moment, but first, a quick word. I do point you to the AIJcast website, which is our fount of information, AIJcast.com. You'll find links there to our artists, to their news, their events, and their products. And I do want to highlight a few of those for you. If you're listening on Friday, December 14th, Dwayne Shivers will be performing tonight at Eddie's Attic, the last of four nights of shows. And next Friday, December 21st, I'll be back at the Basement Theater performing improv. There are 8 p.m. and 10 p.m. shows. And on Saturday, December 22nd, Love Beyond Walls and Wheat Street Baptist Church will be collaborating on Gather Atlanta together. There's also plenty more stretching on into the coming year. Among them is ARC's Theopoetics Conference happening March 22nd through the 24th in Oakland, California. You can find out more information about these events and all of the others at our website, AIJcast.com. And now back to more of our conversation
with Khaled Keith Perry.
Give us a quick and dirty definition of theopoetics.
Theopoetics, the way we use it, is just a shorthand for that intersection. So we sometimes talk about it as what goes on the flagpole. And the question is, you know, what flagpole? And they're like, oh, it's the flagpole at the intersection of care for embodiment, arts, the ways in which community is formed around that, and a concern for justice. Mm-hmm. So when you put all those things together, that is where they all cross. I mean, I guess this isn't a video, so you can't see it. But if you imagine kind of like a cartoony version of all those roads coming together, the place that you call the square or the middle of the connection of all those roads is theopoetic. So when we're being like technical academic-y people, we say that theopoetics has, as a definition, has four different pieces. The first is theopoetics is an emphasis or style or a positive concern for the ways that religious reflection and spirituality plays with imagination, aesthetics, and the arts. And then we say, especially as that play forms community, focuses on actual material change, like the effects of a thing and the actual consequences of it, and doing the above in a way that affirms embodiment, right? So it's a style of art and religious reflection that influences community, focuses on concrete change, and affirms the importance of bodies. 1, 2, 3, 4. One of the things that we're really clear on, as an aside, is that it's not as if there's theology and then there's theopoetics, as if it's a separate thing. Theopoetics is a style, right? It's a genre. It's an emphasis of doing religious reflection, whether that's academic reflection, whether that's just what it means to be a person of faith, thinking about what it is their spirituality means to them. It's about mattering. It's about recognizing that art should matter. Art should have an influence, and it needs to somehow be connected to the stuff of the world. And that emphasis on aesthetics that we're talking about before really plays out, because a lot of times academic religious reflection, commonly called academic theology in the Christian context, doesn't pay a whole lot of attention to its form. It pays attention to its claims, its propositions. And we want to say, fine, make claims, make propositions, but understand that how it is you're communicating this stuff influences who the audience is and what you're able to say.
What are some of the other projects, programs?
Yeah, so that happens every spring. Every fall, we have a kind of academic-only kind of event. Everyone's invited, but the frame of it is at the American Academy of Religion. So it's very academic-y oriented. So it's a working group at the American Academy of Religion where we have a panel of something that is generally open for discussion. And we're pretty clear that even in that kind of academic space, which is very hierarchical and structured, we make sure that there's room for dialogue, that it isn't just a sage on a stage kind of thing where we have some experts, but often there's panels, there's small group conversations, there's talk backs, there's open dialogue, which is very unusual for the American Academy of Religion. In fact, so much so that we have to pay for our own space because we can't be part of the event as a normal thing.
Wow.
Yeah. So we always rent space there contingent and next to what is officially happening, and bring people in to have a different kind of conversation around some of these same topics. And then training-wise, something that you are part of, we have these events that we call Deepening Circles, which is a either 1, 2, or 3 day event, kind of either as a on the longer end, more of a retreat style, on the shorter end, more of a training, where we teach some of the kind of organizational, interpersonal, and individual ways in which this conversation around aesthetics and the arts influences who you can be as a leader So it's and that tends to be for practitioners. I mean, of course, some academics are practitioners, some practitioners are academics, but it runs the gamut, right? So our deepening circles work is for practitioners primarily. Our conference is a mix of all three, of clergy folk, of practitioners and artists. And then our work at the American Academy of Religion is primarily for artists. But of course, I mean, for academics. But when you imagine these topics, there's a lot of overlapping Venn diagrams.
Sure. Yeah.
So we do those pieces, and we've been doing those for years. Just beginning this year, 2018-19, there's two pieces that we're launching on, which are really exciting. One is the ARC Emerging Leaders Fellowship, which is meant to support, network, and resource young adults who are either clergy in training or artists who are emerging artists for whom their work is influenced by their faith commitments, where we bring them together, host them in a retreat, help get them networked, mentored, partnered, provide monthly kind of reflection prompts for the creation of art, engaging what it is that their faith in art has to do with, and then bring them together again as part of the Theopoetics Conference as a track for young adult leaders who are emerging, beginning to kind of resource these folks so they know that they're not alone, and we recognize that they, in fact, are the experts who are bringing the wisdom to the table just as much, if not more, than those of us who are doing this work organizationally already, so that they can know each other, know the people who are rising, and that we are able, in a place right now where we're financially able to support some of their travel, some of their work, and some of their engagement, which is really important to us, that we're helping support the growing crop through these again, emerging leaders. Not that they're ARCS leaders, but they are leaders at the intersection of arts, religion, and culture, right?
Right.
So we're able to do that. And then the other new initiative, which is brand new and either won't be out or will be a very baby by the time folks hear this, is something that is called the ARC Studio, which we think is a first of its kind. It's going to be an online platform where artists can, free of charge, kind of show their skills or portfolios or their projects. And we can make sure that it's there as a clearinghouse so communities of faith that want to use the work of artists better know where to go. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be able to support this kind of platform where artists who want to work with communities of faith and academics who want to talk about the arts and communities of faith can all meet each other and get news of other communities that might want to use their work as artists, or potentially the other way around, where you're an artist and you put your stuff up there and you say, hey, I'm willing to do work consulting with organizations. And that way it doesn't have to just be your own personal website, but we'll be able to push information about artists out into the broader world so people can kind of know that there's a place to go, that if you're wanting to explore what it means to care about the arts and faith, like there's a place to go for that. And right now there isn't a centralized place. And we're not ultimately going to be kind of making that work. That's going to depend on artists themselves kind of wanting to plug in. But the ARC Studio is going to be, what we hope, a place where both people who are people of faith and who are clergy from communities of faith and artists can kind of go to meet each other in the middle, to find each other if there's interest on either end in working with each other. And we're really excited about the kind of what we're hoping, the collaborative stuff that emerges from there.
That sounds amazing. So it's a networking marketplace platform.
Yeah. So it's the way we've been thinking about it is like some kind of combination of like a freelance website. So for example, like Fiverr, yeah, where people's skills are available for hire, a combination of Fiverr and Etsy, but with a community in mind so that you can actually do commissions work. You know, mm-hmm. so that there's a whole big part of where people are talking to one another about the effects of using this stuff. Okay, so we just did this thing, right? Okay, so Martha, you're up there. You're willing to help teach communities of faith how to do podcasting, right?
Yeah.
Great. So that's maybe that's a service you offer. Maybe you're willing to do it free of charge. Maybe you want to charge whatever. That's up to you. That doesn't matter to us. The point is, how do we get this stuff out there so it can all live in one place? That's a kind of its own art form. But then you know, maybe some academic wanders along and was like, hey, what are actually the effects of churches and synagogues and gurdwaras doing podcasting? And so now they contact you and all of the gurdwaras, churches, and synagogues that you've taught. And now suddenly we've got people who are able to do better academic work because of actual work that's on the ground instead of fluffy, whatever thought stuff that comes out of nowhere. It actually
got some data, yeah.
Makes communities. It matters to you as an artist. It matters to the communities that we're working with because of skill building. And it matters to academics because they want to do real work about what it means for people to do art and have it matter to faith. So in all ways, what we're trying to do is kind of loop in relationship, emphasize community, emphasize connection, and just see what happens.
That sounds amazing.
So it'll be, it's either out or not. You'll be able to find any information about it through artsreligionculture.org. My hunch is it'll be in a big, bold logo up at the top because that's how excited we are about it.
It's an exciting development.
Yeah, we looked out at the kind of landscape and said, there's no real one place.
Right. There's a ton of people doing it, but there's no kind of clearinghouse location for it. Yeah.
And we want to be able to, again, for us, it's about making this conversation more commonplace so that you don't have to feel alienated as a person of faith to be an artist or as an artist to be a person of faith.
Yeah. If you had a charge for our listeners, what would it be?
I'm going to tell a story. When I was a freshman in college, I was playing with a jazz band and we had this director, and he would always say to us, all right, we're going to listen to a piece together, and he would bring in tracks from albums, and he'd say, and when it's done, I want us to talk about the piece. And so it would come in, and we'd listen, and we'd have a conversation, and one time he came in, and he played us this track. I'll never forget it. It was Coltrane's A Love Supreme. It was the first track off that album. Now, most of us had heard us because we were like, the number of people who play jazz music is very small. The number of people who play jazz music like up and through college and are playing in lab bands, ludicrously small. So like there's a canon of jazz music too, right? So we've all heard this album. And he says, so like, what do you have to say about this? And someone just goes, wow. And this guy turns around and he goes, never do that again. And everyone said, what? He said, look, there's nothing wrong with feeling wow. But when someone asks you to talk about wow, you better be able to say, what about it was wowie? That's the line. What about it was wowie? And I've never forgotten that he said, there's nothing wrong with feeling wow. I'm not upset for you for saying wow. I just need you to then be able to share what about it was wowie, so that we can start to understand the world around us. So the charge I think I have for folks is to consider the question, what about wow is wowie, right? And whether that wow is a wow of despair, whether that wow is one of profound joy and adoration, and whether that wow is an adoration of Christ's resurrection or a newborn baby's first cry or, you know, what happens when you put on glasses that allow you to see in color for the first time or a really well-placed dinner joke, you know, whatever your wow is, don't let it to just sit in you as wow, but begin to pick it apart. The magic is not ruined when you know more about it. The magic is not ruined when you know more about it. And chances are, if you begin to understand how you got to that moment of transcendence, you'll be able to do a better job cultivating them in your own life and helping other people see and reach them more often too.
Kelly Keith Perry, thanks for being on AIJCast.
Thanks.
Khaled Keith Perry on AIJCast. You can find ARC online at artsreligionculture.org. On our next episode, sensory artist Siana Altice.
AI JCast is made possible through the support of listeners like you. We can only do what we do because of what you do. So please do take a moment, go to our website, AIJCast.com, and click on the link that says support. We also love to interact with you on social media. You can find us on a variety of platforms at the handle AIJCast. Our theme song is written and recorded by the band Marred Fame. Photography support comes from Ely Photography at eleyphoto.com. And we are engineered, mixed, and produced by the always candid Al Mudeef. Al loves to throw his musical expertise around, so we asked him the other day, what is the connection between rap and hip-hop?
It's a style, right? It's a genre. It's an emphasis.
And I'm your host, Marthame Sanders, encouraging you to go and create some beauty of your own. Peace!